Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. On tonight's program, we're updated on ongoing research into attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
ADHD is about 75% can be attributed to what we call genetic factors, genes and how they interact with the environment. And we know that from twin studies.
Plus, we'll talk about the important role of a dietitian during cancer treatment.
The better nourished you are, your body is able to fight back and rebuild and keep going.
And a fascinating exploration of new research into retinal diseases and treatments.
You have to convince that stem cell to become just the type of cell that you want of all the hundreds of cell types that are in the human body. And so that's the problem that we're trying to deal with here.
We'll get advice on developing a dynamic life and hear another great selection from our healing muse. That's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, how a strong diet can help to support cancer therapy. Plus, how a team of local researchers are working on a cure for retinal blindness. But first, the latest in attention deficit hyperactivity research. ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, is the most common behavioral disorder of childhood, and the ramifications of having this disorder are many and far-reaching. We'll hear with more on this as Dr. Stephen Ferrone, a distinguished professor of psychiatry at Upstate Medical University, who has spent the better part of his career looking for answers regarding this complex of symptoms. Welcome, Dr. Ferrone.
Good
Thanks
morning.
For coming in. So let's remind our listeners what we mean when we use the term ADHD.
So ADHD is a disorder, as you said, of childhood, starts in childhood but can go into adulthood. Three cardinal groups of symptoms are inattention, the child's very distractible, impulsivity, they act without thinking, and hyperactivity, they tend to run around a lot, climb on furniture, and do things that are particularly annoying to parents.
So what generally is the incidence of this in terms of, you know, the childhood population?
This has been studied around the world. We now know the incidence it averages around 6%. And you get the same incidence in the United States, in Europe, in Australia, studies in Asia. So we're pretty confident that we know the incidence of the disorder. There's been some concern in the media, particularly, that the incidence is rising.
Yeah, that was my next question. Has it been increasing?
Well, no. The answer is the true incidence has not been increasing. When we look at, over time, studies that have measured ADHD carefully over time, it's been flat over time. So there's no increase in the true incidence of the disorder. There's a possible increase, I say possible because it's not that well studied, increase in the diagnosed prevalence of the disorder, the number of children that are getting diagnosed and treated.
So does that suggest that we're getting better at diagnosing, perhaps?
Well, that's the...
Or are we perhaps over-including? I mean, this is a whole, you know, yes, are we over-inclusive?
That's the million-dollar question, because the studies that have done this haven't actually gone back and tested whether the children whose parents say they had ADHD by their doctor actually did have ADHD by sending someone in the field and checking this out. So we don't actually know that.
So these are reported cases as opposed to really evaluated cases.
Exactly. The most recent one was someone called the parents on the phone and said, has your child ever been diagnosed by a health professional with ADHD?
So what exactly, I mean, you mentioned what it looks like, but how early can you see it developing and what would it look like in a very young child, for example?
Well, very young children are usually very hyperactive and very impulsive. That's the cardinal symptom. The parents are pulling their hair out because this child won't sit still. When they get up in the morning, they are ready to roll. They are hard to sit down at the table to eat breakfast. Difficult problems of that sort.
Do we really understand, though? I mean, I think there's been a lot of speculation, and part of what your work has been. What is the cause of this? I mean, is there any... I'm sure there are hypotheses,
yes,
but what do we have our arms around what could be causing ADHD?
We do. We actually do. We don't. There's a long way to go. We know, for example, that ADHD is about 75% can be attributed to what we call genetic factors, genes and how they interact with the environment. And we know that from twin studies. So if we have identical twins have identical genomes. If one twin has ADHD, The other twin is very likely to have ADHD. Maybe 50% or so will have ADHD. That's a lot different from regular siblings. If one child has ADHD, the sibling's risk is only about 10%. So we know from twin studies that genes play an important role.
So there's a genetic predisposition to it.
Exactly.
But it does it. Does it say, I mean, is it guaranteed, for example?
It's not guaranteed, except perhaps in a very rare cases where somebody has a very unusual genetic disorder, they have a very big problem with a gene is deleted, for example, that might cause ADHD. But for the most ADHD children and adults, we refer to their disorder as multifactorial. There are many, many genes that are involved. It could be hundreds or thousands. Our new data suggests that it is in that order of magnitude, that hundreds and thousands of genes are involved. We call those polygenes. Many, many genes cumulatively add up to create that risk. And the same is true of the environmental risks. So you'll read in the papers periodically, for example, there was a new paper about air pollution causing ADHD.
Yeah, I noticed that, and you actually commented about that. So, I mean, has there been any correlation found between these two things?
Well, there has in this study. And this study shows that children who were exposed to higher levels of air pollution are more likely to have ADHD. Same is true of pesticides. Same is true of exposure to lead. Same is true of exposure to PCBs.
Is it that they have been exposed, or rather their pregnant moms were exposed?
That's a good question.
So that during their development in utero, there may have been some changes.
Most of the environmental causes have been linked to exposure when they were in utero. And we believe that the reason for that is because it's affecting the developing brain, much as the genes are affecting the developing brain. Some studies show exposures later in life, like, for example, pesticides, may also play a role. But most of this is what's happening to the child as the brain is developing early in life.
Do we have any idea if, I mean, is there, you said in the beginning that obviously it does exist throughout life, this syndrome. Do kids, some kids just grow out of it? In other words, do they kind of organize themselves such that, it's no longer a symptom or a complex of symptoms?
Yes, in fact, about a third of kids will, we've done studies, for example, where we diagnose kids in childhood and we follow them into adulthood. Other people have done studies as well. When I looked at all those studies together a few years ago, I estimated that basically a third of children will grow out of their ADHD by young adulthood, meaning that we find no signs of the symptoms or their impairments. Two-thirds of them continue to have the diagnosis or many ADHD symptoms plus impairments that would continue to
evolve.
Continue to evolve.
So in other words, they begin to, as a result of having these symptoms of ADHD, other problems kind of get exacerbated.
Well, that's right. Well, ADHD is an early warning sign that other problems may occur. So about half to two-thirds of ADHD children will have subsequent problems with learning, learning disabilities, antisocial behavior. Not a lot of them, but many of them go, some of them go on to lives of crime, criminality.
Yeah, I remember seeing some studies looking at that, too.
It's a very good study in Sweden where they have very extensive records on these issues, and they showed that, quite interesting, not only does ADHD lead to criminality later in life, but people who are treated for their ADHD are much less likely to enter into criminal behavior. And people who are treated for ADHD are, when they go off their medications, are more likely to engage in criminal behavior. Now, I don't want to scare mothers and fathers out there. So this is a small subset of ADHD children. But it is an issue that has to that is a concern.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with researcher and professor of psychiatry, Dr. Stephen Ferrone, and we're talking about ADHD. Some have suggested, and I want to get to your research in a sec, some have suggested, though, that this idea of ADHD is more a factor of our world and how where it's highly demanding, highly structured, and in another era, perhaps, these kinds of kids wouldn't have been diagnosed in this way. They just would have found another way to make their lives work. What do you think of that?
It's a very good question, and it has some merit. It's important to note that ADHD has been around for quite a long time. The first evidence of it in the literature, someone writing about it, goes back to the 19th century. The first presentation in the medical literature was in the turn of the 20th century. A British psychiatrist wrote an article about what he called disorders of moral control. But when you read his paper, it's about ADHD. So it's been around for quite a while, so it's not simply the result of our modern society with video games and iPads and things of that sort. On the other hand, ADHD is to some degree an interaction between the ability of the brain to organize the environment and the pressures that the environment places on that brain, the challenges that are placed on that brain. So, for example, some people with, you might think of as relatively milder ADHD, might do pretty well as if it's young children, even as adolescents. But as the world requires them to organize life by themselves, their ADHD seems to emerge. Because, for example, if they had a parent that was very organized and the teachers who helped them with their homework and organized their homework as children, they could do pretty well. But they get to a time in high school where they're expected to do their own homework, they're expected to organize themselves more, or in college where the pressures and challenges of organization are much higher, then the disorder can emerge. Typically, people like that, when they come to a doctor and say, I've got some problem here, I can't seem to do what other people do, you look back in their childhood history and you see the signs back in childhood. They were there, but they were kind of damped down because the external world was helping them self-regulate their behaviors.
So you've done a tremendous amount of research in this whole field, and I'd love to talk specifically about some of your work. There was a study that you did, for example, or looking at, there's been much speculation about the relationship between autism spectrum disorder and ADHD. And I'd be curious to know what you found or what you think exists there.
This has been a question for a number of years because people who work with children that have autism spectrum disorders have noticed that they seem to have fairly high rates of ADHD. Maybe 30% or so or more will have ADHD symptoms. Until recently, it was technically impossible to diagnose a child with both disorders. The official criteria for autism said if the child had an autism spectrum disorder, you couldn't diagnose ADHD.
So it had to do with the diagnostic categories.
It had to do with the diagnostic categories that the two were separated at. And they were separated at because they seemed to be very different disorders, ADHD, inattention, hyperactivity, impulsivity, autism, social communication deficits, withdrawal, stereotypical repetitive behaviors. But lots of research has been done, and we now know that the two disorders frequently co-occur. And that when ADHD occurs in children with autism spectrum disorders, it responds to the same medications. And so we've been looking at, for example, the possibility of common causes between those two disorders.
And that, in fact, it might even be a continuum of some kind? Does that exist?
Well, the concept of a continuum is one that's been around for about 20 years in psychiatry and psychology, perhaps even longer. It's actually been gaining momentum lately because the more data we collect, the more we see that each of these entities we call disorders occur in a spectrum. I like to think of it as similar to somebody having high blood pressure. Everybody has a blood pressure, but there's a cut point where a doctor says, your blood pressure is too high.
Mm-hmm.
Hypertension, non-hypertension. And they might lower that. In fact, a few years ago, they lowered the threshold because they realized people at a lower level needed to be treated. To some degree, ADHD, autism, even schizophrenia are like this. There's a spectrum of conditions from severe, very severe, to very mild, and all of us have a little bit of inattention every now and then.
Is that also, you've done work in looking at the relationship between mild traumatic brain injury and ADHD. So tell us about that, how that plays a role here.
It's interesting. It goes both ways. People who have had a closed head injury are more likely to have ADHD symptoms because their brain is affected. And people who study that have actually found that the changes in brain structures you see at the closed head injuries that accompany ADHD are similar to the changes in brain structure we see with ADHD. So we think of it as a, if you will, an environmental cause of ADHD on the one hand. But on the other hand, children with ADHD, adults with ADHD, are more likely to get into accidents, more likely to have injuries that lead to TBI, traumatic brain injury, and
So it's hard to really tease out which came first.
It goes both ways, essentially. It can go both ways.
How about PTSD? I saw that a little bit of time we have left. You've done some work looking at the potential for somebody who suffers from ADHD to end up being more prone to something like PTSD at some point in their
lives. That's right. Post-traumatic stress disorder, not frequently, but 10-20% of the time, people with ADHD, because they get into traumatic situations, we think because of their ADHD, they end up having a post-traumatic stress disorder subsequent to that trauma. There may also be biological underpinnings that are shared between the two disorders, and we're looking at that now, but that's for future work.
It sounds like there's a lot of future work. So what needs to be done? Where are you headed in your research? What are the questions that remain unanswered at this point that we need to have help?
Well, we're headed in a few directions. The main direction right now is to try to pin down which genes are involved in the disorder. I said before, there's many polygenes, perhaps hundreds or thousands. We'd like to pin down at least a few of those to help us define what are the biological pathways in the brain or elsewhere in the body, perhaps in the immune system, that are causing ADHD.
And then perhaps be able to target those in terms of therapy, it would
exactly.
seem. Exactly. Either medically, chemically, or even behaviorally.
Exactly. We might find, for example, I have had a student here who was studying the effects of Chinese herbs on ADHD symptoms and showing some efficacy for those. And understanding those biological pathways could help us treat the disorder better.
Well, it sounds hopeful. Very exciting, but also a lot of work to be done. My guest has been Dr. Stephen Ferrone. He's a distinguished professor of psychiatry at Upstate Medical University. Once again, thanks so much for joining us. You have such a wealth of information for us. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Next up, how a strong diet can help to support cancer therapy. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Well, cancer and its treatment can affect your appetite, your eating habits, and your weight. But it's important for people with cancer to maintain a healthy weight, to get essential nutrients, and to remain as physically active as possible. Working with a registered dietitian can be instrumental in creating a comprehensive care plan for cancer patients. And here with more on this is Maria Erdman. She's a registered dietitian nutritionist with the Upstate Cancer Center. Welcome, Maria. Thanks for coming in. So cancer and its treatment can really affect your appetite, your eating habits, and your weight. Help us understand that.
Well, cancer cells are human cells that grow a lot faster than regular cells. So some of the treatments attack fast-growing cells. The cells in our gastrointestinal system are also fast-growing cells. And for that reason, they're affected more than other cells in the body. And that leads then to some of the symptoms you've probably heard of, such as nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and just lack of appetite.
But how about the treatments themselves? Like, are the side effects of surgery, the side effects of, you know, as you mentioned, the chemotherapy, radiation, do they also have an effect in terms of people's appetite reduction and maybe just not being up to eating, not being interested in eating?
It can make people fatigued and therefore just they get too tired to want to get up and take care of eating meals. Radiation, depending upon where it is, can cause pain in the throat and esophagus and therefore make it hard to eat. Also, if it's down near the colon, it can cause diarrhea.
So who are the patients? I mean, are there cancer patients who are more adversely affected than others, for example?
Patients who have head and neck cancer, esophageal cancer, lung cancer, and cancer of the stomach are patients who we definitely follow right from the beginning because the treatments are probably going to involve some sort of surgical removal, possibly of some of the areas that food usually travels through. They might need something like a tube into their stomach or their small intestine to help them eat while things are healing. Radiation can also cause burning sensations and make it too painful to swallow or to eat. So that can be a big problem.
Are some people also apt to gain weight?
There are some cancers where a greater majority of the people will end up gaining weight. Breast cancer actually is one of those because of some of the treatments are hormone-based and therefore they do tend to help people gain weight rather than lose it.
So they increase appetite or are there other weight gaining
Maybe
aspects.
A little bit. I'm not sure exactly how that
mechanism
works, but
you have seen weight gain because I saw that.
Right, actually
referred to.
So for some of those patients, we're doing a weight maintenance or loss program for after treatment.
So basically, a dietitian's like yourself, specializing in oncology,
really understand that it's crucial for a nutritional program to be put in place for cancer patients. Well, first of all, why is being well-nourished during your cancer treatment so very important?
Cancer treatment can be very difficult. Some people sail right through, but for many people, it's very challenging because it's attacking the cancer cells, which, as I said, are, you know, regular human cells with a growth problem. They overgrow. It also can affect regular cells and therefore make you feel tired and weak. The better nourished you are, your body is able to fight back and rebuild and keep going. And so people who lose too much weight, they lose muscle mass and become weak, and they're not able to function well. So sometimes the cancer treatment has to get put on hold.
So once again, the general nutritional recommendations during cancer treatment are to maintain a healthy weight and to get the essential nutrients that your body needs. How does a dietitian help you do that?
Well, a dietitian can help you. There's things that have been studied, research that's been done that shows that certain ways of eating are more beneficial to a cancer patient. Often patients who eat small amounts frequently throughout the day have a better chance of not experiencing as much of the nausea and keeping down more nutrition. It's also very important for patients to know how to get the most nutrient-rich foods. Foods that have good healthy fats, lots of nutrition, lots of protein, so that the small amounts that they're able to eat have the most amount of nutrient in them.
So basically your job is to analyze what they're eating, figure out how to enrich their diet in some way, and also perhaps adapt the texture of their foods and
for
a whole variety
patients.
Of things like that to make them more apt to eat and able to eat.
Right. Some patients, for example, somebody who has some burning in the throat, might need some more liquid food. Maybe anything solid might hurt them. So I have smoothie recipes that have all the essential nutrients in them. And, you know, people, if they haven't done something like this before, they just don't really have any idea of, if I can't eat, what do I do? So we explain to them how maybe even to puree their foods with extra liquids so that they can then eat it more easily.
So is part of your role also to work with the family members and people who are living with this cancer patient?
Yes, I frequently speak to the significant other and whoever is the person who does more of the cooking in the household. I also work with the pediatric patients, so there I'm obviously speaking with the parents to a great degree.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Upstate Registered Dietitian Maria Erdman. We're talking about the role of a dietitian and the importance of a dietitian's role in cancer care. So you were alluding to some of the more troubling side effects. Tell us more about them and how do they interfere with getting adequate nutrition?
Well, nausea and vomiting are the most obvious, and when somebody feels nauseous, it's extremely difficult to eat anything or even to look at food sometimes. So what we tell those patients is, as I said before, small meals frequently spaced throughout the day, because if you put too much in, that can lead to more nausea feeling.
Do you also do things like if food tastes funny? Because I read somewhere some of the cancer treatments make you have a metallic or bitter taste in your mouth all the time. Is there a way that you can alter their diet so that it's a little easier? Things don't taste quite as strange?
There are some tricks. That's one of the harder ones. And at that point, sometimes I say to people, just eat as much of this nutrient-dense food as you can. You almost have to think of it as a medicine. But there are some mouth rinses that they can use to help just rinse that taste out right before they eat. Also, we tell people try sucking on hard candy, peppermints, lemon drops, that type of thing, or putting lemon juice into water and drinking sips of that between tastes.
How about things like, for example, eating more liquids or getting more liquid through things like soup, for example, or milk substitutes or milk as a way of getting your nutrients, as you mentioned, smoothies before, rather than basically food that you have to really spend a lot of time working at?
Well, that can work, and there are some supplemental shakes that you can purchase from the store. Those can be extremely helpful for some patients who don't have the energy to keep getting up and getting food. I'm sorry, what was
the I actually read something that I thought was kind of interesting, that a recommendation about brushing your teeth before eating, which to me sounds counterintuitive for all the reasons we know in terms of dental health. But also, I always felt that if I brush my teeth and then, you know, before eating, well, we do that in the mornings, obviously, but right before every meal, you would think that it would alter your ability to enjoy the food in a way. The taste of the toothpaste or the mouthwash would kind of take over.
Well, some patients also end up getting very dry mouth and very thick, sticky, mucousy saliva. So in that case, brushing that out of the mouth certainly helps those people to be able to swallow well. And if you just don't use too much toothpaste, it shouldn't be too much of a problem.
How about using plastic utensils versus metal? Have you found that makes
a difference
too?
Yeah, that's another thing. Some patients, if we use plastic instead of the metal, they don't have the funny metallic taste quite as badly. Also, it can be a good idea to give people room temperature foods so that smells don't hit them, which can cause nausea.
Those are really very solid tips. And so when you work with a patient, you basically analyze their needs and then you come up with basically a regimen and these kinds of tips to help them in their particular circumstance.
That's right. And generally I don't. Somebody once asked me for an actual meal plan. And the reason that I don't generally do meal plans per se is because sometimes one thing will seem attractive to a person, and then later they say, oh, I can't eat that. So it's difficult to do that, but if they have multiple ideas of small meals they can have, then they can pick and choose from those whenever they are able to eat.
It sounds like there's a lot of concepts here also underlying it in terms of all the little tricks in your pocket, but also the idea of small meals and more liquids, nutrient-rich shakes, that kind of thing. How about dietary supplements? To me, that always comes up as an issue with cancer. I mean, people are saying, well, if I take high dose, whatever.
I do get a lot of questions about that. It is, evidence shows at this point, the research shows that getting your nutrition from eating a variety of healthy fruits and vegetables, whole grains and lean proteins is really the best way to go. There's so many different nutrients in food these days. We know it's not just the vitamins and minerals anymore. There's lots of phytonutrients, there's the fiber, and it's all important. It's in a package. So taking that away and trying...
In a natural package.
In a natural package. Trying to say, well, I'm just going to take this vitamin. We don't actually know if that's going to be helpful, especially at large doses. Things can interfere with your treatment, with the absorption of other nutrients. So it's really better to maintain just a healthful diet.
And we also know that these vitamins are often not regulated in terms of strength or in terms of even quality.
Some of the supplements.
So you don't really know sometimes what you're getting.
Especially some of the herbal supplements have not been, they're not regulated, so it can be difficult. A multivitamin, I do want to say, can be sort of a safety feature, you know, so just in case you're not able to eat everything in a certain day, if you take a multivitamin, that's okay.
You do recommend that.
Yeah.
So how about food safety, and is that of special concern to cancer patients, and why?
Some cancer patients, certain chemotherapies can cause a patient's immune system to be depleted. And at that point, then, they need to be a little more careful, possibly, about making sure that the food they're eating is clean and not contaminated. So washing fruits and vegetables carefully, cooking meats to the proper temperatures, reheating foods to the proper temperatures, and just making sure that where you're eating, that you know where your food is coming from and that it is safe.
And also, there was something written about sell-by date. I mean, I know we often kind of, there's a lot of humor around this idea of not eating something that's after the sell-by date. But is that real for cancer patients? Should they be very careful with that?
Sell-by dates, usually food is still good after that. It's kind of the first possible date that there could be anything, you know, less than perfect about the food. But it's probably, if you have a decreased immune system, it's probably a good idea to, you know, try to keep to the freshest possible foods.
So in the very little bit of time we have left, what would your overall recommendation then be for someone with cancer?
Try to eat small, very nutrient-dense meals frequently throughout the day. It's good to have things like nuts and avocados laying around to eat, and get everything from fresh foods, and go to a registered dietitian if you need help.
Thank you so very much. It's very helpful information. My guest has been Upstate Registered Dietitian and Nutritionist Maria Erdman from the Upstate Cancer Center. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up, a Nobel Prize for our lives or research. Well, folks, how do we decide what to do with our lives day by day, minute by minute? You know how people are always saying, go with your passion. Right. When I've lost my way and I hear somebody say that, I always think, okay, smarty pants, if I knew how to do that right now, I wouldn't be sitting here listening to you do your passion. I'd be someplace else doing mine. So just how do we grab hold of our passion? It's not easy. Sometimes there's a lot of noise and smoke, like noisy, I should be doing this's, or smoky, my parents thought I'd be good at that, or I'd make more money doing that. So we can't just go with what our head or other people say. We have to search our heart and gut for what feels right to us. Peering and listening for the zings and pings, zipping and zinging through smoky and noisy. Then transform zingy pingy into fiery purpose, because research shows a good chunk of happy is purpose. And research shows goals chock full of purpose drive us to staying on task. And research shows consciously and publicly committing to chock-full goals supports our toiling through thick and thin. And oddly, whether or not we succeed, pointing our toil to purpose and goals produces passion. Want a hint? If you're like a lot of us, the flash and zing link to love, and the peeps we love. For example, Harvard researchers just developed embryonic stem cells that transform into insulin-producing cells, which could cure people with diabetes. Amazing, huh? But here's the backstory for you and me. 15 years ago, the Harvard researcher's six-month-old son had developed type 1 diabetes. Loving his son and wanting to make his son's life better, Dad committed to finding a cure, built a team, and worked for 15 years. Voila, finally. I'll bet they get the Nobel Prize for Medicine. Now, you and I might not be on the stage in Stockholm thanking Mr. Nobel anytime soon. But I don't know about you. I'll settle for the Rich O'Neill Prize for developing a dynamite life. How about you? I'm Dr. Rich, zingy pingy kaboom O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
Coming up next, meet a local team of researchers who are working on a cure for retinal blindness. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And it's time for your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of December 22nd. Avoid deprivation disaster. Listen closely to this one. Don't try to abstain from your guilty pleasures during the holidays. Learn how to balance your favorite foods and help you maintain your weight without feeling cheated. The key word is portions. Reduce your serving size of calorie-dense foods and fill your plate with high-fiber fruits, veggies, beans, and whole grains. Enjoy a tempting food this week by planning ahead and keeping portions small. You can easily mix vegetables in with your favorite entree, start your meal with a large salad, or add fruit to a bite or two of your favorite dessert. So take time this Monday to brainstorm solutions for your next party or get-together, and don't deprive yourself. Choose a small, healthy portion and enjoy. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. There's been much written of late regarding the use of stem cells to help cure debilitating neurologic diseases, as well as their role in the treatment of a wide range of other diseases. We'll hear with more about an exciting new research project in stem cell use in generating retinal cells to preserve vision. Our Dr. Michael Zuber, he's associate professor in the Center for Vision Research in the Department of Ophthalmology at Upstate Medical University, and Dr. Andrea Vitsian. She is an assistant professor also in the Center for Vision Research in the Department of Ophthalmology, both from Upstate Medical University. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for asking us.
So you, Dr. Zuber, you've just been given a very sizable grant to study a way to generate eye cells. Tell us about it.
So the grant was provided by the Research Foundation of SUNY. And what they're trying to do is to get groups across SUNY campuses to collaborate on projects that they would otherwise not be able to do on their own because of the different expertise. And generally speaking, what the grant entails is try to do exactly what you said. We're trying to find a way, a more efficient way, to convert cells that aren't retinal cells into retinal cells.
Okay, so that let's go back a little bit, Dr. Vitsian. Mm-hmm. What, help our listeners understand, what is the retina? Why do you need to replace the cells? What happens when blindness occurs? I know there are a lot of diseases that will deteriorate the retina.
Sure. So the light, the retina is the light-detecting tissue that lies behind the lens in the back of the eye. And it's made of seven classes of cells. And three of these cells, these cell classes, have been found to be particularly sensitive to degeneration. And so there are several different types of approaches to prevent or delay retinal degeneration, and there's other types of treatments that allow for repairing the retina. One of the ways that we think is the most effective is cell replacement therapy.
Yeah, so the idea here is, I mean, I know with the aging population, there are a lot of degenerative diseases, macular degeneration,
age-related things
that cause blindness. And so what you are both doing, it sounds to me, is to try to find a way to preserve people's blindness even in the face of these kinds of disease entities. Is that a correct statement?
Well, preserve the retinal cells. Well, not really preserve the retinal cells, but replace the retinal cells that are lost during blindness. So in a lot of these diseases, what ends up happening is because they're nerve cells, they die off. Once they die off, they're completely lost. So we're just going to be replacing the cells that are lost during these retinal degenerations.
So how do you go about that, Dr. Zuber? What's the concept here? We've talked, I know you were here once before, and you're doing some other research in this area. How do we replace retinal cells?
So in the case of this project, what we're doing is we're taking stem cells that have the potential, you mentioned stem cells earlier, mm-hmm. to potential to become any cell type of the body, right?
So those are, let's just for our listeners, a stem cell is basically an embryonic kind of cell that hasn't decided what it's going to be when it grows up.
Exactly. And that's great for people who want to do cell replacement therapy, but it's also horrible for people who want to do cell replacement therapy because you have to convince that stem cell to become just the type of cell that you want of all the hundreds of cell types that are in the human body. And so that's the problem that we're trying to deal with here, is we're trying to find a way to specifically tell the retinal stem cell, or sorry, the stem cell, we need you to become a retinal cell, but not only a retinal cell, but this particular type of retinal cell.
So how does that work? In other words, where do you get these cells from? And I know you've done some initial research in this area.
Right. Well, there's lots of different sources of stem cells. Right now, there's a technology to take skin cells or blood cells and turn them back into stem cells, and those are called induced pluripotent stem cells.
And that's a key point here because obviously for all the years early on where stem cells were being coveted, there was the problem, the kind of moral or ethical issue of taking them from unborn fetuses.
Absolutely.
That's no longer needed.
Yeah, it is. The induced pluripotent stem cells do have sort of overcome that ethical issue, but they have other problems too. So you have to characterize them in a very specific way in order to be able to use them down the road for stem cell therapy or cell replacement therapy. So they've got other problems that the embryonic stem cells don't have. So you have to be kind of careful in the way that in the types of stem cells or the pluripotent cells that you choose to reprogram. But the idea is once you have those pluripotent cells, then you have the added problem that Mike mentioned, which was that then you have to move these cells to a retinal sulfate, and not only the retinal cell, any kind of retinal sulfate, but the retinal sulfate that you want to replace in the blindness that you're looking at.
So in other words, they have to replace a particular kind of retinal cell, not just any retinal cell.
That's right.
And exactly. That's where the problem is. But it sounds to me, and I think from an earlier discussion I had with you, Dr. Suber, that in general, this is the greatest challenge with using stem cells. It's basically convincing, I'm putting that in quotes, convincing the cell to become something it hasn't decided to become yet.
That's
exactly,
right.
Yes.
Whether it be a bone cell, a cartilage cell, a heart cell,
exactly.
Whatever, you're trying to figure out what to do to make this cell become what you want it to be.
Yes, and the worst part about that, of course, is that these cells could also become cancerous and tumorigenic. And so that's what you're trying to avoid as well, is not only trying to get them down the retinal lineage, but then not get them to the place where they're continuing to proliferate and grow.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with researchers Dr. Michael Zuba and Dr. Andrea Vitsian, and we're talking about their research into regenerating eye cells to cure blindness. So how are you going to go about this, either one of you, in terms of this is you have a technique called membrane permeable transcriptional regulators for retinal repair. That's a big title. What does it mean?
Well, so generally speaking, there are a group of genes in cells that are called transcription factors, and these genes are very powerful because they can control other genes. They turn other genes on, they turn other genes off, and they do that on multiple genes.
They're like the control panel?
Exactly.
Like the
They're like the switch that you turn on the switch from a particular transcription factor, and it'll turn on all the other genes that are necessary to make a particular cell type. And the problem is that those genes are normally in the cell already. And so now that we've using the frog, and we talked a little bit about that before,
explain that. So you're using frog cells, not human cells at this point.
No, at this point we are using human cells at this point.
And
mouse cells is actually what Andrea is using.
Yeah, okay.
So, but we did these early studies in the frog because it was easier to do the experiments very quickly and very fast in the frog. And that allowed us to identify just 7 genes that were required to reprogram pluripotent cells into retinal cells.
Just to, again, pluripotent means it can become anything.
That's right. That's a stem cell.
That's a stem cell.
Right. Go ahead.
Yeah.
So now that we've identified those 7 genes, it turns out they're all transcription factors, these switch genes. And the problem now is how do we get them back into the cells? So stem cells that were growing in a culture dish, we can't just inject every stem cell and get them all to become the cells. That's too problematic. So what this grant is doing is we're testing a new procedure by slightly modifying the proteins. We can then just add them to the culture dish, and they get across the membrane of the cell.
So they get absorbed.
Exactly.
That's right. It's almost like you're fooling them.
Right, exactly.
Putting it in their world,
that's right.
And they just kind of suck it up.
That's right.
That's right.
That's exactly right,
yes. Yeah.
So is it happening? I mean, where are we at with this?
We're at very early stages. We're just learning about the membrane permeable tags and how well they cross the membranes of these stem cells right now. And we found one that seems to be working better than others, And so we're testing that further by adding it to the transcription factors, but we're still at very early stages of this project.
So the concept here, though, is are you working with human cells? No, you both are working with animal models.
That's right.
But your colleagues, as part of this grant across SUNY campuses, are also working with human cells. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right.
So simultaneously, you're both trying this same concept of the permeable transcriptional regulators?
Yes, exactly. So we're doing the work here in mouse and in frog cells, and then our collaborators are doing the work on the human cells.
And where are they?
So they're over at SUNY Buffalo.
Okay.
Yeah. And there are doctors Gail Siegel and Steve Fleisler and Jun Q.
Okay. So what's the hope? And what's the time frame? And what do you think will really happen? Pie in the sky. What can come of this?
So in the 1 year of funding that we have, the goal is to first demonstrate that we can get these transcription factors into the cells by modifying the way we described, and then also showing that once those transcription factors are inside the cells, they can reprogram them to start to express genes you would normally see in a retinal cell. Okay, that's the funding that we have right now. The purpose of this funding was also, in addition to get us to collaborate with other SUNY campuses, was to build preliminary data. And so the funding is, like you said earlier, it's just a 1 year of funding.
It's like a seed grant.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. And so if we can generate the preliminary data that says, hey, this is working, this is a great approach to do this, then we can, with our collaborators, go to the NIH or the National Institutes of Health and ask for additional funding and say, hey, look, we've already got this working. You know, we need some more money to try to go ahead and take this to the next step.
Which would be
taking those mouse cells and then transplanting into a retinal degeneration model in the mouse. Not only do we have to show that those cells in the culture dish are actually expressing the genes we expect a retinal cell to express, but they also have to be able to functionally recover the disease, right? So once we get the cells in the culture dish to express the retinal genes, we then take a mouse model that has retinal degeneration and replace the cells in the mouse to see if they can then integrate into the retina and cure the blindness of the mouse.
And you're saying that the people in Buffalo will be doing that with a human model.
Well, they won't be doing it with a human model. So what they'll be doing is showing that human cells could then be reprogrammed into retinal cells. And at that point, the functional studies would have to come into effect. But really all the work on seeing whether or not the cells that were becoming retinal cells were functional would have to be done in the mouse. So we couldn't take the human cells. We could take some of the human cells and put them back in the mouse because people have done that.
But you're not yet ready to do that with human trials. That's quite a distance from
now. That's a big distance from now. I mean, there's several different things that have to take place before that.
But the basic concept here is once you've convinced, in quotation, these pluripotent cells to become a retinal cell of the type you want, the theory would be that you could somehow insert it into, down the road, a human who is losing their ability to see.
That's right.
And the cell would know where to go and what to do and find its little new home back in the retina and provide sight.
Is that the bottom line? Yes, that's exactly the therapy
It's extremely exciting potential.
Well, thanks. Yeah, yeah. We're both really excited. I mean, the reason why I became a researcher was because I wanted to find a possible therapy that would cure blindness. That's the reason why I'm here.
And why that? I mean, why that in particular?
Because
we have very little time left.
Okay, sorry. I am an artist, and I draw a lot and paint a lot. And the worst thing that I could see happening to myself is my loss of vision. I couldn't imagine what that would be like.
I certainly can relate to that, but I'm sure most people out there who have sight would feel the same way. I hope you'll come back and tell us more.
Absolutely.
At a point at which you have some results.
That would be wonderful.
It's very, very exciting research.
It's
I want to thank you very, very, very much. My guests have been Dr. Michael Zuber, and he's from the Center for Research for Vision Research from the Department of Ophthalmology at Upstate Medical University, and Dr. Andrea Vizian, also an assistant professor in that same department and doing some very exciting research. Thank you both very much. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, dear
Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Most of us are veterans of signing forms, especially if we're having a procedure done. Nurse practitioner and poet Vineta Masson offers us a lighthearted yet penetrating take on what we really know when we sign off on these innumerable forms of disclosure. She starts us off with a brief epigram from Hippocrates, one of the earliest physicians, who believed that physicians should not always tell the patient everything. Here is her poem, Full Disclosure. Perform your medical duties calmly and adroitly, concealing most things from the patient while you are attending to him. Maybe they have it right, those who say the truth is too strong for a person who's sick. Look at it this way. Full disclosure means telling you that some illnesses elude all cures, that each life has a span, and yours may be short, by which I mean shorter than mine, that beneath the veneer of medicine lies the bedrock of uncertainty, that medical research is not rocket science, it's infinitely more complex, that experts, like search engines, traffic in theory, conjecture, shaky data, and sometimes outright hoax. Now the good news. You may recover despite stiff odds. The body is smarter than you can imagine. The world of healthcare has fixers and healers. What one can't do, the other can. This is the truth. If you're the sick person, sign below to acknowledge receipt.
Joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore how dancing can inspire and help patients with Parkinson's disease. Plus, we'll discover the lesser-known consequences of weight loss surgery. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLink on Air, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Jennifer Conjol and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.